Chapter 32. Skimmings, at butter makings, at cheese makings, among broody poultry, and among farrowing pigs, as no milkmaid was ever wooed before by such a man. Tess knew that she must break down. Neither a religious sense of a certain moral validity in the previous union, nor a conscientious wish for candor could hold out against it much longer. She loved him so passionately, and he was so godlike in her eyes. And being, though untrained, instinctively refined, her nature cried for his tutelary guidance. And thus, though Tess kept repeating to herself, "I can never be his wife," the words were vain. A proof of her weakness lay in the very utterance of what calm strength would not have taken the trouble to formulate. Every sound of his voice beginning on the old subject stirred her with a terrifying bliss, and she coveted the recantation she feared. His manner was what man's is not, so much that of one who would love and cherish and defend her under any conditions, changes, charges, or revelations, that her gloom lessened as she basked in it. The season meanwhile was drawing onward to the equinox, and though it was still fine, the days were much shorter. The dairy had again worked by morning candlelight for a long time, and a fresh renewal of Claire's pleading occurred one morning between 3 and 4. As he had run up in her bedgown to his door, to call him as usual, then had gone back to dress, and call the others, and in 10 minutes was walking to the head of the stairs with the candle in her hand. At the same moment he came down his steps from above in his shirt sleeves and put his arm across the stairway. "Now, Miss Flirt, before you go down," he said peremptorily. "It is a fortnight since I spoke, and this won't do any longer. You must tell me what you mean, or I shall have to leave this house. My door was ajar just now, and I saw you. For your own safety I must go. You don't know. Well, is it to be yes at last? I am only just up, Mr. Clare, and it is too early to take me to task," she pouted. "You need not call me Flirt. 'Tis cruel and untrue. Wait till by and by. Please wait till by and by. I will really think seriously about it between now and then. Let me go downstairs." She looked a little like what he said she was as, holding the candle sideways, she tried to smile away the seriousness of her words. "Call me Angel, then, and not Mr. Clare. Angel. Angel, dearest, why not? 'Twould mean that I agree, wouldn't it? It would only mean that you love me, even if you cannot marry me, and you were so good as to own that long ago." "Very well, then, Angel dearest, if I must," she murmured, looking at her candle, a roguish curl coming upon her mouth, notwithstanding her suspense. Claire had resolved never to kiss her until he had obtained her promise. But somehow, as Tess stood there in her prettily tucked up milking gown, her hair carelessly heaped upon her head till there should be leisure to arrange it, when skimming and milking were done, he broke his resolve, and brought his lips to her cheek for one moment. She passed downstairs very quickly, never looking back at him, or saying another word. The other maids were already down, and the subject was not pursued. Except Marion, they all looked wistfully and suspiciously at the pair, in the sad yellow rays which the morning candles emitted in contrast with the first cold signals of the dawn without. When skimming was done, which, as the milk diminished with the approach of autumn, was a lessening process day by day, ready and the rest went out. The lovers followed them. "Our tremulous lives are so different from theirs, are they not?" he musingly observed to her, as he regarded the three figures tripping before him through the frigid pallor of opening day. "Not so very different, I think," she said. "Why do you think that?" "There are very few women's lives that are not tremulous," Tess replied, pausing over the new word, as if it impressed her. "Here's more in those three than you think." "What is in them?" "Almost either of them," she began, would make a proper wife than one. "And perhaps they love you as well as I almost." "Oh, Tessie. there were signs that it was an exquisite relief to her to hear the impatient exclamation, though as he had resolved so intrepidly, to let generosity make one bid against herself. That was now done, and as he had not the power to attempt self-immolation a second time then, they were joined by a milker from one of the cottages, and no more was said on that which concerned them so deeply. But Tess knew that this day would decide it. In the afternoon several of the dairyman's household and assistants went down to the meads as usual, a long way from the dairy, where many of the cows were milked without being driven home. The supply was getting less as the animals advanced in calf, and the supernumerary milkers of the lush green season had been dismissed. The work progressed leisurely. Each pailful was poured into tall cans that stood in a large spring wagon which had been brought upon the scene, and when they were milked the cows trailed away. Dairyman Crick, who was there with the rest, his wrapper gleaming miraculously white against a leaden evening sky, suddenly looked at his heavy watch. "Why, 'tis later than I thought," he said. "Egad! We shan't be soon enough with this milk at the station, if we don't mind. There's no time today to take it home and mix it with the bulk afore sending off. It must go to station straight from here. Who'll drive it across?" Mr. Clare volunteered to do so, though it was none of his business, asking Tess to accompany him. The evening, though sunless, had been warm and muggy for the season, and Tess had come out with her milking hood only, naked armed and jacketless, certainly not dressed for a drive. She therefore replied by glancing over her scant habiliments, but Claire gently urged her. She assented by relinquishing her pail and stool to the dairyman to take home, and mounted the spring wagon beside Claire. In the diminishing daylight they went along the level roadway through the meads, which stretched away in 2 gray miles, and were backed in the extreme edge of distance by the swarthy and abrupt slopes of Egdon Heath. On its summit stood clumps and stretches of fir trees, whose notched tips appeared like battlemented towers crowning black-fronted castles of enchantment. They were so absorbed in the sense of being close to each other that they did not begin talking for a long while, the silence being broken only by the clucking of the milk in the tall cans behind them. The lane they followed was so solitary that the hazelnuts had remained on the boughs till they slipped from their shells, and the blackberries hung in heavy clusters. Every now and then Angel would fling the lash of his whip round one of these, pluck it off, and give it to his companion. The dull sky soon began to tell its meaning by sending down herald drops of rain, and the stagnant air of the day changed into a fitful breeze which played about their faces. The quick silvery glaze on the rivers and pools vanished. From broad mirrors of light they changed to lusterless sheets of lead, with a surface like a rasp. But that spectacle did not affect her preoccupation. Her countenance, a natural carnation slightly embrued by the season, had deepened its tinge with the beating of the raindrops, and her hair, which the pressure of the cow's flanks had, as usual, caused to tumble down from its fastenings and stray beyond the curtain of her calico bonnet, was made clammy by the moisture, till it hardly was better than seaweed. "I ought not to have come, I suppose," she murmured, looking at the sky. "I am sorry for the rain," said he. "But how glad I am to have you here." Remote Egdon disappeared by degree behind the liquid gauze. The evening grew darker, and the roads being crossed by gates it was not safe to drive faster than at a walking pace. The air was rather chill. "I am so afraid you will get cold, with nothing upon your arms and shoulders," he said. "Creep close to me, and perhaps the drizzle won't hurt you much. I should be sorrier still if I did not think that the rain might be helping me." She imperceptibly crept closer, and he wrapped round them both a large piece of sailcloth, which was sometimes used to keep the sun off the milk cans. Tess held it from slipping off him as well as herself, Claire's hands being occupied. "Now we are all right again." "Ah, no, we are not. It runs down into my neck a little, and it must still more into yours. That's better. Your arms are like wet marble, Tess. Wipe them in the cloth. Now, if you stay quiet, you will not get another drop. Well, dear, about that question of mine, that long-standing question? The only reply that he could hear for a little while was the smack of the horse's hoofs on the moistening road, and the click of the milk in the cans behind them. Do you remember what you said? I do, she replied. Before we get home, mind. I'll try. He said no more then. As they drove on, the fragment of an old manor house of Caroline Date rose against the sky, and was in due course passed and left behind. That, he observed, to entertain her, is an interesting old place, one of the several seats which belonged to an ancient Norman family formerly of great influence in this county, the D'Urbervilles. I never pass one of their residences without thinking of them. There is something very sad in the extinction of a family of renown, even if it was fierce, domineering, feudal renown. Yes, said Tess. They crept along towards a point in the expanse of shade just at hand at which a feeble light was beginning to assert its presence, a spot where, by day, a fitful white streak of steam at intervals upon the dark green background denoted intermittent moments of contact between their secluded world and modern life. Modern life stretched out its steam feeler to this point three or four times a day, touched the native existences, and quickly withdrew its feeler again, as if what it touched had been uncongenial. They reached the feeble light, which came from the smoky lamp of a little railway station, a poor enough terrestrial star, yet in one sense of more importance to Talbothays Dairy and mankind than the celestial ones to which it stood in such humiliating contrast. The cans of new milk were unladen in the rain, Tess getting a little shelter from a neighboring holly tree. Then there was the hissing of a train, which drew up almost silently upon the wet rails, and the milk was rapidly swung can by can into the truck. The light of the engine flashed for a second upon Tess Durbeyfield's figure, motionless under the great holly tree. No object could have looked more foreign to the gleaming cranks and wheels than this unsophisticated girl, with the round bare arms, the rainy face and hair, the suspended attitude of a friendly leopard at paws, the print gown of no dater fashion, and the cotton bonnet drooping on her brow. She mounted again beside her lover, with a mute obedience characteristic of impassioned natures at times, and when they had wrapped themselves up over head and ears in the sailcloth again, they plunged back into the now thick night. Tess was so receptive that the few minutes of contact with the whirl of material progress lingered in her thought. Londoners will drink it at their breakfasts tomorrow, won't they? She asked. Strange people that we have never seen. Yes, I suppose they will. Though not as we send it. When its strength has been lowered, so that it may not get up into their heads. Noble men and noble women, ambassadors, and centurions. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.